Monster Man, special episode, The Absence of Monsters. Hello, and welcome to Monster Man, a show about monsters, because monsters are great. I'm James Holloway, and I'm reading my way through the gaming books of yesteryear. And as I do, I'm taking a look at the monsters that I find in them, their history, their mythology, their ecology, their imagery, and how to use them in games. Today's episode is a special episode, brought to you by the generosity and public spirit of my Patreon backers, and in particular, of Patreon backer Tobias. If you'd like to be like Tobias and get your own special episode, all you have to do is go to patreon.com/monsterman and pledge at the $5 level. And if you do that, you'll also get the rewards for all other tiers, including all new episodes of my other podcast, Patron Deities. So Tobias, thank you very much for your support, and I hope that you enjoyed today's episode. Before we start, I also want to thank another Patreon backer. Yes, like I said, this is someone who's gone to patreon.com/monsterman, and they've pledged as little as $1 a month to help keep the show on the air. So thank you very much to returning patron, Keith Parker. Tobias has asked me to talk about monsters being missing or monsters being removed, the absence or loss of monsters. And this episode is partly inspired by the short story Readings in Slantwise Sciences by Sophia Samatar, which I will put a link to in the show notes. This short story is a collection of other little, even shorter stories that includes one about basically fairies dying off in the world, declining fairy populations. And that is mainly sort of set up as an analogy about declining insect populations in the real world and the sense of kind of ecological grief that is such a part of the modern world. But also, it's maybe about, and you know, I don't really know, it maybe like any good story, it rewards revisiting, but there's an aspect as well, which is about feeling nostalgia or feeling loss for a thing, the experience of which is not itself actually pleasant or which is not friendly to you. I think that's in there as well, which I guess you could say is an ecological metaphor as well. It's part of a tradition of fantasy fiction in which the loss of monsters in a setting is symbolic to some extent of like the loss of a sense of the uncanny or of magic. And I think that there is something to that. I'll quote some lines from it if I can just find them. Did I say this is called Readings in Slantwise Sciences? It is called Readings in the Slantwise Sciences. And the version that I'm reading was published in Conjunctions magazine. Conjunctions.com. Around her, the shelves and tables stocked with preserved fairy corpses, some nearly as old as her last appearance on this stage, transformed the lights of the theater into an amber essence, which I realized too late was a virulent form of concentrated grief. Siggy is right. If the fairies go, we're done for. We may, with our vast ingenuity, figure out some way to endure the coming disaster. We may find refuge in underground shelters, asteroids, giant rotating space stations, or alien planets yet unknown. But without the elemental spirits of our fields and forests, we can only ever survive. We cannot live. And I think that the world of both fantasy literature and fantasy gaming has this as a pretty common element. The idea that the world was once magical and that creatures like elves and fairies and hobbits no longer exist in a mundane modern world. This story is a little unusual in that it presents the time of that transition and then analogizes that to other things that contribute to the value of living in the world. But you can see that conceit in Middle Earth. I think, right, there's remarks about how, you know, like hobbits used to exist. Middle Earth is the ancient history of our world, I suppose. But also you get this in other fantasy novels like Michael Scott Rohan's Winter of the World books, although there it's been given more of a science fictional or like more grounded in real world science and ecology. And I think that it's an expression of an interesting kind of nostalgia, this desire to be in a monster-filled world. A more dangerous world. We know that the world is a dangerous place, right, with wolves and bears. And yet we have a kind of nostalgia for that world, an awareness that there is something lesser about a world that no longer has these kinds of creatures in it. I don't know that people who live in places where there are lots of wolves feel that way. They have good, grounded, and yet sort of mundane and unromantic concerns about their sheep. I think that there are three ways to approach this type of sense of loss about monsters. I'm going to call them the defender version, the conflicted version, and the loss version. Let's run through them. The Defender version seems like the most D&D gameable and yet not to me. I'm sure that it's been made into a video game many times. It's possible that's what the Monster Rancher series is about. I actually don't know. So in this version of the setup, the PCs are essentially some kind of monster conservationists. They could be advocating to try and keep, you know, developers out of an area where there's lots of monsters. They could be rangers protecting a monster reserve from poachers. They could be monkey wrenching some logging company that's trying to take down the monster's habitat. By monster conservationists, I mean that they are interested in conserving monsters, not that they are conservationists who are also monsters, which is, of course, the premise of the role-playing game Werewolf the Apocalypse. I think that this is a pretty common way to feel about the tropes of adventure gaming, and it's also a consequence, like, both of the way the games are marketed and of a shifting perception of monstrousness in our popular culture, right? So, like, the novel boom of the 1990s, notwithstanding, the quote-unquote main characters of D&D, of fantasy games in general, are the player characters, which means you can't really use them in marketing. I get that there's Drizzt and Brunor and whoever, and I get that in 3rd edition they tried to make us feel attached to Jozan and Krusk and Regdar and Miley and Lyta and all those guys. This is how we feel about Krusk and Regdar. Who cares? What this means is that the most recognizable faces of Dungeons & Dragons are actually the monsters. Beholders and dragons, of course, and owlbears, and I think that there is a kind of, you know, for any monster that has any lovable qualities at all, even if that's just their appearance, there is essentially a woobification process that takes place. Something starts out as a villain and eventually becomes lovable. There is a Facebook group that I keep seeing posts from, even though I'm not a member of it because Facebook has figured out I like comic books. But I keep seeing posts about what a great guy Dr. Doom is. You know, they don't come much less of a great guy than Dr. Doom, but he has his rare moments of wit or badassery. I hold to the, was it Mark Waid or who said, Doom is regal but not noble? I love that. Anyway, I think people like owlbears. I think when you fight an owlbear, you are a little conflicted because they're like fluffy friends. But you're also conflicted because our understanding of the conflict between humanity and nature has changed. When you're in school, they teach you this idea of, like, these are the types of conflict. There's man versus man versus himself, blah, blah, blah. And one of them is man versus nature. And typically this is expressed through reading this story To Build a Fire, which is a quite scary story about the challenges of survival in very cold environments. But the problem with this is a little bit like the King Kong problem. Specifically, in the conflict between man and nature, it's pretty clear that man is winning, or at least has been winning and may now be suffering the consequences of that. But my point is, we now often view certain types of monsters as the underdogs. Modern adaptations of King Kong struggle with this because the premise of the original King Kong is sort of like, I know this gorilla seems like a scary monster, but it's actually got some, like, touching and relatable qualities. Whereas now, our assumption on seeing a gorilla in a movie is that it has touching and relatable qualities. Remember when there used to be sympathetic media portrayals of big game hunters as characters? It's hard to imagine that working with modern day audiences. So the idea that monsters are sympathetic and need to be protected from bad guys, let's call it the save monsters, fight villains model of the game, I think it makes a lot of sense. I think it works for modern audiences, and I think people enjoy maybe the idea of having monster pets or allies, or like having monster-based powers. I think there's a lot of fun to be had there. You could give people sort of totemic relationships with particular types of monstrous creature. Obviously, this works largely on the analogy with monsters and animals. So it doesn't work so well when you're just trying to defend marauding orcs. The thing about the marauding orcs is all the marauding that they do. But this model of action and adventure isn't really what the story is talking about, I don't think. A little closer to the mark is the conflicted version. So in popular media, I feel like maybe it's just Dragonheart. Is that the one with Sean Connery? And who's that? Is it Dennis Quaid? Anyway, that one. This is often about dragons specifically. The idea that dragons are dangerous, but they also represent a kind of majestic nobility, and that, you know, even though you might have to fight and slay this one, the world is a finer place with dragons in it. This is a feature of my D&D campaign, where there were once 8 dragons, so I did that thing that I always said I was going to do, where there aren't, like, red dragons, there's just the red dragon. There were 8 dragons, and now there are, like, 3 or 4, because, you know, they've been slain or they've vanished over time. This has a tendency to give a game a little bit of a melancholy tone. You know, once there were monsters everywhere, a dangerous landscape, but a landscape of magic. You know, that landscape is being replaced with a quote-unquote civilized one. This is like for all of those settings where the prevalence of science takes away magic. Which I'm not sure is true, right? We have societies that have high levels of scientific education, but yet also where people believe in essentially forms of magic. It doesn't really seem like they're incompatible. But like I said, it's a romantic view, and maybe there's like a kid's adventure version of that. When you take things that ought to be scary and violent and you make them appealing and fun. The classic example of this would be pirates. Wouldn't it be cool to live in a world where pirates exist? Gentlemen of fortune. I'm aware that we live in a world where pirates exist. I mean, like, with tri-corner hats and sailing ships. Gentlemen of fortune sailing the Spanish Main, boarding my ship, stealing my life savings, and, I don't know, torturing me to death for being a Catholic. So, you know, realistically, it doesn't sound so great after all, but the pirate story lives in the tension between legendary swashbucklers and real armed robbers. So there's a fictitious pirate world where, you know, you're going to swing on a rope between two ships and then, like, sword fight a guy, and that sounds amazing, but there's also a little frisson of horror in that idea because you know that actual pirates were a pretty dangerous bunch and you wouldn't want to be involved with them. Similarly, the conflicted monster slayer lives in the tension between the fantastic worlds of wonder and danger. Now, on a cynical reading, this might be kind of like the Mobile Suit Gundam version of this conflict. I watch a lot of Mobile Suit Gundam by a normal person standards, although not a lot by a Gundam fan standards. And particularly the kind of like classic Mobile Suit Gundam stories, the so-called Universal Century ones, and also spin-offs that stay close to those shows in terms of like tone. They have a little bit of a formula. And the formula is that there's a bunch of thrilling mech battle action, and then the characters are super sad about that, right? Like, they're sad about how all they know how to do is fight and kill. Couldn't they one day have a normal life, you know, looking after these orphan children or marrying this princess or devoting themselves to their art or whatever it is, right? A lot of the time, the, like, cool teenage robot pilot archetype is subverted by making that character a traumatized child soldier. And that's not something that originated with Evangelion by any means. Like, that's actually the mainstream for mecha anime. I think it's more mainstream than Gundam. But then they go and have another thrilling mech battle. So you get to enjoy your thrilling mech battles, but you also get to feel grown up because you know that you're not romanticizing warfare. But you're still not prepared to not have the thrilling mech battles because they're so thrilling. We want the action and danger of monster fighting, but we also want to grapple with its ethical concerns to some extent. We certainly don't want to ignore that they exist, even if it's just the characters periodically going, oh, woe is me that I must destroy the thing I love. Still better than like, ha, another owlbear down. Score one for Owlbear Bill. And this is kind of where I'm sitting in my D&D game. I play a ranger who's a hunter, and he definitely likes animals more than people. And, you know, he's got a whole animistic belief system where he thanks the spirit of the animal and blah, blah, blah. So I get to be a pitiless hunter and also be in touch with nature. But I don't think that either of those quite match the tone of the story here, because the tone of the actual story is about loss, is about the end of this thing, this weird and even dangerous or negative thing that we nonetheless need to survive, or I guess more, to live beyond surviving, to have wonder and magic and the uncanny, to feel at home with the spirits of our fields and forests. So in a way, it's not a specific analogy for ecological grief, or at least that's not how I read it. It's an evocation of that mood, but also an attempt to make fairy creatures weird and grotesque, even while they're being used as a stand-in for something sympathetic. I'm still thinking about that story, but I do wonder if its mood is very translatable to conventional gaming, to adventure gaming, because, like, I think if you do translate that idea, you're going to have to present it as a problem, which this story very much doesn't. Or I shouldn't say that. I mean a solvable problem. Because I think that a Star Trek version of this is possible, right? Where the loss of a species from an ecosystem, even an explicitly magical one, can be a problem that you need to deal with. And in fact, arguably, mature AD&D, with its focus on the ecological aspects of fantastic creatures, could be a really valuable choice here, or at least those books could be a really useful resource, because they're the ones that talk about the reproductive cycle and mating and so forth of all of these different fantasy creatures. And the reason I say that the Star Trek version probably works a little better in an adventure game is like, so a little while ago, I went to an event for the LARP that I plan, and each of the events is a little bit different themed. So in the previous one, we were in a setting that was having an election and we were trying to get our favorite candidate elected. And this involved doing all of our usual shenanigans, but also like meeting with potential supporters and trying to get them on side or raising money for the campaign, often by heists and so forth. That works okay, even if the kind of like action-adventure character base doesn't always necessarily overlap well with political intrigue. But the most recent one was a little bit horror-themed, and I think it mostly went very well, but there was one linear, as they are called in the LARP world, that I didn't quite gel with, and the reason for that, I think, was that it was very horror-y, right? So we went off to go help some people, but it turned out that the people were dead, and then like a monster chased us around the woods for a bit. And the problem with this was that the player characters on the linear, myself kind of included, kept trying to problem solve, kept trying to figure out how to get past the monster, how to help the people, how to get back to the ships or whatever. And maybe it's just that it was daylight when we were doing this, because we were in some spooky woods, but you know, it would have been more atmospheric, although probably not as safe, in darkness. So for us, I think the problem was that this was a scenario that was all about atmosphere. What we were supposed to do was sit and soak up the scene-setting horror atmosphere of mysterious things running around in the dark woods and us not really knowing where we were and so on and so forth, and just kind of build the mood. But that's something horror characters do, and we're action-adventure characters. So as action-adventure characters, we kept trying to problem-solve, which just meant that we wound up getting frustrated because that wasn't what the scenario was designed for. And that's what I mean you might run into here. If you are heroes who solve problems, you hunt down bad guys, you go on quests, you defend villages from marauding orcs, all that kind of thing, you're probably not going to react well to a scenario where the main point is for you to explore and experience this kind of elegiac mood of environmental grief, this romantic yearning, nostalgia, if you will, for a vanishing world. Instead, you're going to want to figure out how to solve the problem. And I think that that works better if you're playing on a smaller scale. So if you have to, like, escort a breeding pair of owlbears to a new habitat, or sabotage the hunt of a big game hunter who wants to kill an owlbear in the region, or retrieve an owlbear egg from a collector and take it to the shrine of the life goddess so that it can be incubated, or whatever. I think that kind of thing, where the ecological problem-solving aspect overlaps with traditional action-adventure quests and heists and so forth, I think that that can work very well. Because ultimately, action-adventure games are played in an action-adventure way, and if you put players in a situation where they're just supposed to be experiencing a mood, they'll do it, but if that mood is, what a huge downer, I think they might find it a little frustrating. In real life, our awareness of the loss of our planet's biodiversity is a pretty bad feeling, and I don't think that art can't explore that, but I will say that that art is probably not going to match up with, like, the median emotional tone of a fantasy adventure game. Does that make sense? In fact, you know, having said this, we've talked about ecological monsters and senses of grief when talking to Ruth Kitchen Tillman when she was on the show, talking about the creeping kudzu. There, of course, it's the other way around. The environmental catastrophe is symbolized by the arrival of a monster. A monster that is moving into a new habitat because of the ways in which the environment is changing. So that's something different too. So I think there's nothing wrong with that either way. You just have to be cautious about whether everyone's in the same neighborhood. Because if there is a player who plays in order to overcome challenges, or plays in order to experience a fantasy of power or heroism, and instead you present, you know, this is about exploring a single emotional beat, and also that emotional beat's a massive downer, you're probably going to get some pushback. This is one of the challenges of adapting other media or adapting, you know, big ideas to RPGs, which is that they essentially can't help but become a little more RPG-like in a way which can sometimes water down their meaning a little bit by hybridizing it with the existing play practices of the genre. But I think that it's just something that happens. I don't know that there's anything you can really do about it. And therefore, I think you have to be in control of the process, if that makes sense. And the way to do that is to, I think, you know, because I think you can have a compromise. I think you can respect the loss and not have it be like, oh, the player characters, you know, put the MacGuffin in the MacGuffin hole and now everything is fine, while still having a little bit of a win. So it's like, oh, well, we're going to get this breeding pair to safety. That means this monster will continue to exist somewhere, even though most of its habitat has been wiped out. Or we know that we're not going to be able to stop every big game hunter from killing an owlbear, but we can stop this guy from killing this one. So that's like a little bit of a victory. You can have these little bittersweet emotional moments, but they do have to have a little bit of the sweet in them. And I think that the easiest way to do that is with a more conventional adventure structure, right? Because a lot of adventures are designed around the idea of locating, retrieving, or protecting something valuable. But what if that something valuable was, you know, our planet's biodiversity? You know, another thing that you could do would be have the players intentionally have to reintroduce a monster to a landscape that no longer had them, right? The idea of the absence of a monster being a big problem. This is a little bit like rewilding, but could also be that, you know, you have some spell that you need some component for, right? Like Dark Lord Zergithrax is going to get the blue jewel and cover all the lands in a second darkness. And the only thing that can stop him is, you know, the Brew That Is True, where you need the fang of an owlbear, but there haven't been any owlbears since the last ones were hunted into extinction by greedy nobles from the greedy nobles camp across the lake or whatever. And so then maybe you even have to go down into the underworld where you find all of the things that have been wiped out and you have to bring this one back. Or maybe you have to go and obtain a sample of owlbear DNA from some creature that extracts its victim's DNA, right? There's probably some monster like that or some mad necromancer or whatever, and then you can get your hands on the sample and go and clone an owlbear or whatever it might be. So I think that that could be a fun quest, the idea that there's this sort of legendary monster. You could set it up in advance too. Maybe, you know, you find ancient shields made of owlbear hide, and you're like, ah, yes, this legendary creature once blah, blah, blah. And then you might feel bad about, I know I said fang of the owlbear, I don't think they have fangs, but you know what I mean. Then you might feel bad about bringing this creature back into the world only to harvest its parts for a magical spell and so on. I think there's something there. I think there's something in that. Especially I like the idea of, you know, I've probably run two or three Unknown Armies games which all have this idea of like an other space where things that are discarded go. And one of them was this place called the Big Rock Candy Mountain, which was kind of the heaven of these people who were mages who were all about things that are lost. So they were detritomancers. That's a whole other story, and I'll talk about it a different time. But I think there's something in that quest, and the idea of bringing back a legendary monster. Maybe some genuinely scary real monster is the lesser form or the descendant, you know, like birds from dinosaurs, or the counterpart to this creature. So, you know, maybe the owlbears are running around, but you need to bring back the bear owl. I think there's some possibilities there. So Tobias, thank you very much for your support, and I hope that you enjoyed today's episode. Everyone else, if you'd like to be like Tobias and get your own special episode, remember that all you gotta do is go to patreon.com/monsterman and pledge at the $5 level. In our next episode, well, you know what? I've been given three choices for the next episode by the patron who's requesting it, and I'm still torn between them. They're all pretty good. But it'll be definitely one of those next time, right here on Monster Man, a show about monsters, because monsters are great. Thank you for listening. If you've got a favorite monster or something you'd like me to talk about, why not get in touch? I'm on Twitter as @GonzoHistory, on Mastodon as GonzoHistory@dice.camp, or you can find me on Instagram at MonsterManGonzo, or drop me an email, gonzohistory@gmail.com. Our theme music is an extract from Solve the Damn Mystery by Jesse Spillane from the album Descent of the Goober Monster and is used under a Creative Commons Attribution License. Our cover art is by Ray Otis. Thanks for listening, and please join me next time for Monster Man, a show about monsters, because monsters are great.